part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Well, let's start with the interview, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it.
Shall we begin? All right. Well, let me start by saying that this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. And my name, as always, is Christian Horn. And I have a very special guest on the line. I have Dave Dwanch on the line, who is a creator of many things, like so many comic things, like comic book related things. And I've wanted to have him on the podcast for years, and we've just never done it. Like, we've just never gotten together and done it. I mean, I think I met you when you were at Action Lab, like even way before the Baby Badass thing and any of that stuff, where my friend Dave Schrader kind of got us, or I helped get us into Action Lab, and then that got published through that company. But I think I was going to interview you, and then we kind of chatted and at San Diego Comic-Con, and as things often do at San Diego Comic-Con, it just kind of like didn't happen. And then whatever, the, you know, time goes on, and here we are finally chatting about your new Kickstarter.
Well, we're both trapped inside our offices, so it makes it really convenient.
Oh, is that it? I finally cornered you in your office.
Oh, no, no. Life cornered us into our offices.
Yeah. We were just before we start, you know, started chatting, we were looking at each other's offices because we have video on, and we were like, oh, you have Shogun Warrior. Dave has Shogun Warrior, like the old 70s, 80s toys, right, in your office, and you were commenting about my office, which is a mess right now. I don't even want you to see it, but you can probably see those comics in the corner there.
This is a podcast meant for video, but check out this awesome gold couch of mine.
You do have
it's like Dave. I literally am the Biggie Smalls of comic books. Yeah. It is crazy.
Dave has a gold couch in his office. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. You can't see it, but I can see it and I can verify that. So Dave, let's talk about your Kickstarter, because anyone who has a Kickstarter, I like to start off by saying that there is a Kickstarter that you are running right now. And as of right now, of this recording, it's like 12 days left. By the time this goes up, probably be 10 days left. So we want people to throw money at it. It's called Spores, the Broken Circle, but it's a sequel to another book you did, which I have a pull quote. I have the book right here.
Oh, yeah, you do.
On that book.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. So
I love it. Yeah, worlds are colliding as we speak.
Exactly.
This is great.
It's like a Seinfeld episode going wrong or right.
Yes.
I don't know.
So the Broken Circle, I always intended for Spores to be a trilogy. And now that I'm like looking at that multi-eyed beast, I think that I could do more, but I'm going to keep it at three. I may do a spinoff here or there just because I've kind of grown attached to the concept and the characters. But it like follows around a group of kids that they're kind of like spoiled rich kids that all go to a private school in upstate New York. And it's kind of like a little nod to the X-Men in that regard. But
isn't everything though in comics, Dave? I think everything is at this point, right?
Everything except those Fox movies.
Exactly. The things that they intended to be. Yeah, all right. Go on.
So it basically follows these kids through their growing pains and their kind of social dilemmas of figuring out how to navigate prom. And then on prom night, what appears to be a zombie outbreak happens. And so in that first volume in Prom of the Dead, it's literally about a bunch of kids in a gym.
Yeah.
And in this, in the Broken Circle, it's really about that day after. And it really is, they've kind of gone through that odd birthing channel where they were these kind of naive, spoiled kids that have now they're tasked with survival, on their own. So it's part road trip. It's still a bit of self-discovery. We're going to introduce a bunch of new characters into the mix, and then we're going to show why it's not a zombie outbreak in this one, which I think is the more interesting bit of it, right?
Interesting. I remember when I first read it and you sent me the digital edition to check out, and I think I picked this up at a convention, maybe, I don't know which one, but, and I have it signed by you here, Prom of the Dead is the original one, and it says part one in the Spores trilogy. But what you want to look up on Kickstarter right now is called Spores, The Broken Circle. That's what you want to find, Spores, The Broken Circle. But the original book is called Prom of the Dead. And I remember reading it and thinking, like, this is kind of like Day of the Triffids meets, like, Night of the Living Dead, like, sort of thing. It's more of sort of a plant-based vegan, like, zombie apocalypse,
So I don't want to spoil too much, but the zombies are definitely like a stage one in what would then become more of a sci-fi Red Dawn. So that's kind of where we're headed, and it's a lot of fun, because when I was writing it, you know, at that point we were inundated with zombie stuff, and I was like, I really want to do something that is that, but not that. And I just stupidly love, like, teenage, like, CW dramas. It's like crack cocaine for me. I don't know why.
Like, are we talking about the superhero stuff or just the Riverdale stuff? Or, like,
well,
like,
you know,
the 100? Is that what we're talking about?
So the 100's very similar. But for me, like, I'm a huge fan, like, growing up in the late 80s, early 90s of, you know, the 90210s of the world. And then later the OC is like my jam. Like, I will watch the OC like I watch Edward Scissorhands. Like, once a year, I just get a hankering for it. And I mean, they're like perfect for what they are.
Really?
Like, yeah. Like, you know, like, there are some people that probably don't buy in on stuff like Edward Scissorhands or stuff like the OC, but, like, I love the most perfect expression of whatever it is, even if it's the dumbest crap, you know? I mean, and that's probably why people still have a romantic bone for, like, a monster like Michael Jackson, right? Because at the time, he was the most perfect pop star you could ever have.
Yeah,
and he did it so well, right? No excuses, none of that. And then, like, later on, obviously, it comes out of how much of a shithead that guy was. But
all shitheads at this point? I mean, the Woody Allen documentary just broke on HBO, like, last night, and I'm terrified of watching it. I mean, we already know, but... just like, oh God, like, was everyone that I watched growing up just a complete asshole? Like,
I mean, God help anyone that's associated with, like, Miramax or something like that. You're just like, man, you stick around long enough. I mean, like, honestly, this isn't one of the ones that I dread, but, like, when I'm on interviews, man, I wake up with night terrors. Like, oh shit, did I say something? Did I say anything out of turn or, you know, cause I mean, we've both been in this business for a long time, and we've seen people rise and become jerks. We've seen people, meander and try to take everyone down with them. We've seen everything, right?
Yeah.
And that was part of the reason I had to get out of being a publisher. I just, you know, I was a creative director over at Action Lab, and I didn't love being, like, having everyone's hopes and dreams pinned on what I did. You know, like, we all know that comics are like a tough game, and then putting that on my shoulders across 70 books a year, that was too much for me. And I'm an emotional writer, I'm an emotional creator, an emotional person. And I just was like, man, I think I just need to get back to what made me love comics in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, like, making them, right?
Yeah. You know, you started off as sort of, I mean, I remember discovering you as creative director of Action Lab, right? And and you were just saying that you didn't necessarily love that job, but there must be, but you love creating comics, but it seems like what you're doing for your own comics is like creative directing as well, right? Because, I mean, you're sort of doing, I mean, you're writing your comics, right? But you're not necessarily illustrating them, correct? I mean, and then you have, like, lots of projects going on at the same time. Part of what I was thinking last night was, like, how does this guy, because you're constantly making things. I mean, anytime I see you on social media, it's something new and you're moving forward. So, it seems like you're heavily invested in comics and, you know, the creation of comics, you know, but I guess the balance was that you didn't necessarily want to be in charge of, like, 60 other titles, right?
Right. Yeah. I think that's the thing. I loved finding things, at conventions. Like, you'd walk around the convention floor and find cool projects that you're like, wow, if I could, you know, amplify these voices, that would be great. It would be awesome. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, I got into comics because I had stories to tell. And like, to me, it's all about storytelling. And that's why I started out as an artist. Like, it took me a while to get to the root of why I was drawing in the first place. And it was literally just so I could tell stories, right? And then I was like, well, there are way better artists than I am and faster than I am that could tell my stories and make books that are now our stories, right? And I love that aspect of comic books, that it could be super collaborative. And I think it probably helps that I'm an artist. Because, you know, I'm writing with a visual, with visual cues in mind. I know what a story should look like. And when it comes to collaborating with artists, a lot of them, I mean, have been very, very awesome to collab with. You know, they take not just direction. It's not like me correcting people's artwork, but it really is trying to get to the best elements of storytelling, and and they elevate me and I elevate them. And you know, it's like Santi, you know, he did Prom of the Dead with me and he did Mind Palace with me, and now we're back on Broken Circle. I feel like we've like developed a friendship over miles. Like, he lives in Argentina, I've never met him. You know, English isn't his first language, and yet we speak the language of comic books, and we trust each other so well now that like I can write a script now and give him shorthand because he understands what I mean, right? Whereas, you know, you start writing for people you don't know and don't necessarily trust right off the bat, and your scripts tend to be twice as long because you have to be more descriptive, right?
No, it's interesting about you mentioning about that sort of like letting go of your artist sort of things, the artist aspect of yourself, I mean, which so that you could get to the point of creating comics. Because, I mean, that's sort of one of the thing I know, one of the things I know that I myself struggle with, and a lot of other sort of like comic creators, they want to make their own thing and have it be completely theirs. Can you talk a little bit about like letting go of that aspect of yourself and just being able to sort of like trust that things were going to go okay with different or new artists?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, like for me, it's now it's to the point where, you know, I still have a full-time job. I mean, you know, that's why I'm kickstarting, right? Cause it's like, it's hard to justify the expense of comic books when you're a writer. And I think that, you know, a lot of times writers get bum raps, like where you're like, artists are like, man, you know, I'm not going to take any jobs unless I'm paid. And I totally agree. I'm not saying that shouldn't be the case, but you also have to understand where the writer's coming from too. It's like that writer's not really necessarily made of money, right? I've been lucky enough to have a really good full-time day job with great benefits, that allows me to, you know, go on these weird flights of fancy, right? But justifying that to your wife is a whole different situation, right? Like, she doesn't have a hobby that costs her $10,000 per project, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I get, and you know, and as I've our relationship has grown and matured, I'm finding it harder to justify that, right?
Yeah.
But well, but I had on the kids other in side. There.
And,
oh God. Oh my God. No. Yeah. That was like a very conscious decision on our part too. We were like, we're just going to travel and do our thing. But, you know, now it's gotten to the point where as a writer that I do want to draw, I really do have that, like that itch I want to scratch, but it's almost to the point now where I'm less trained. Like I'm not as fast as I was even at the height of when I was drawing. And even then I wasn't very fast. So it's like, you know, so that project that I'm going to eventually draw has to be something that I am willing to live in for like 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, and I just don't have that level of patience for myself anymore. It's frustrating. I mean, you know, and that said, I've designed stuff for people. Designing is fun. Like cover design and character design, that's great stuff. Like, but you know, I would akin that to being like a character designer and an animator. Do I want to draw the thing 20 times or do I want to draw the thing 50,000 times?
Right? Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting because I took some storyboarding classes, animation classes, you know, as part of my education, and one of the things that I always wanted to do for myself was get into like character design or something like that, like coming up with new characters. That was the one thing that I always loved when coming up with my new ideas was sitting down. Like I was into role playing games and stuff like that. And it was like drawing other people's characters for them. Like that was like the fun thing, you know, when you were sitting and just sitting at the table and just being like, you know, doodling stuff out. And then once you take those animation classes, it's like, you know, the guy's basically saying, well, you got to animate to be able to design characters for animation because you need to know how, you know, animation works and how they move and stuff like that. And I was just like, oh my gosh. And it's funny because like getting into drawing my own comic stuff for my own personal journey, I'm sort of like discovering it's like, you know, drawing all the panels, like I like doing it, but then when your day job has sucked all the energy out of you at the end of the day, it's like, dude, do I really have to draw this trash can like in the back of the alleyway? Like, you know what I mean? It gets sort of, you sort of get to a place where it's like, you know, where is the enjoyment of all this for me? You know what I'm saying? And I'm sure that you've dealt with that as well, right?
Oh, for sure. And like, and I don't even know. I mean, you come from, a professional art background where, I mean, it's your day job.
I really don't. Like, I'm self-taught. I'm completely self-taught. Yeah.
But what I mean is if your 9-to-5 is art-based, then going another 8 hours and drawing more is a whole, I mean, you've got to already be tired. Your mind is working. Like my day job is in booze and I'm an analyst that gets to drink booze. And I'm like, part of my job is tasting new product and figuring out what the risk reward is for bringing that into a chain of, you know, beverages and more. You have them out in California. I work Bevmo, in their office. Right? Yeah. So I'm one of the spirit analysts. I work for another company that's kind of brought in to help guide them with their assortment planning and stuff like that. So it's like more about using a different side of my brain. Yeah. It's like a salesman side, which I mean, might have something to do with creative writing. I definitely have to be somewhat creative, but it's not like grinding out art every day and then working, you know, an extra 8 hours on art every day. Like, I can't imagine people that do that. And there are, and pretty much everyone that's in art has done that at one time or another.
Yeah.
You know, because they're just so talented. Of course, they've locked down a secure day job doing that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the best artists, I mean, I don't want to say the best because I don't want to compare people, but I think that if you're not an animator and you want to get into comics, I think animating really preps you for that that repetition. Yeah. And I also think that like, you know, people that do caricatures also are really prepped for doing comics too, because they deal with expression, they deal with likenesses, and they have to do it fast, right?
Yeah.
So I was never built for any of that. I was never fast. So there was just no way. Like I had my own webcomic, but you know, a page a week is easy.
Is it? You know, even for me, that's like rough sometimes.
You've got kids and you have a day job in art. So there you go. I mean, it's the work-life balance that's really, really tough, right? And that's tough for everybody. And I get it, but artists have it rough, especially.
Well, talk to me about like getting into comics, because I mean, did you say like you started drawing your own stuff, right? And did you ever, you know, pardon my ignorance, but was there, was there a book that came out that you fully drew and like did everything on your own or like at least drew and then worked with somebody else to like ink or color or anything? Did anything come out, or did you like have to let go of that and then just jump into like using other artists right away? Because,
I started out on my own, I think in 2005, I want to say, and I did a book, I did it independently, and then it got picked up by Super Real Graphics, Jason Martin.
He
got folded into Action Lab. When I went over there, I was like, why don't you come run the R-rated stuff, because my mind's not wired to deal with that.
And so
he published a couple of books of mine. He did one called Special Education, which was about a remedial class in a superhero high school. So it's all the kids with like loser powers.
Okay.
And very animated style. And then I did another book called Gnome.
Right. Okay.
I drew that. And then I did a web comic called Spacetime Condominium, which is like, everyone loves that. It was like Rick and Morty before Rick and Morty was out.
Oh, nice.
I met so many like weird Hollywood execs that were like, we finally found you in Artist Alley. We've been reading this comic forever. And I'm like, what? Yeah, like Warner Brothers Animation was interested in it for a hot second.
And, oh, nice.
And that was like something I did. And then when Action Lab was born, we did a real short run printing of that book just as a compilation. And then after that, it was like, I started Action Lab, didn't have any time to draw anymore because I was running a business.
Yeah.
Loosely. I am air quoting business. Right.
Meaning
now.
The business is Action Lab.
Yes, right. But my job there was like to find books to add to their library of books. And I really focused on the all ages stuff, found Princeless.
Yeah.
And Jeremy, that was like my thing. And then I found Dave Pepos and Spencer Locke, you know, your book, which is more driven by Jason, but, I'm trying to think of, I mean, you know, there are hundreds of books that they've put out. And then, you know, again, just pounding that your head against that wall. I feel like comics, that's what it is. It's like, you're going to pound your head up against a wall until you break through.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, I'm 47 and, I'm now just finding some success in comics, which is to say
now just little. Finding, I mean, you put out Gnome and you've put out several books. I mean, this is funny because this is a thing that came up in another interview that I did with the creator of Athena Voltaire, which is like, what is the success that you're looking for? You know what I mean? Like, what is the thing? Because you've got lots of stuff. I mean, you know, Double Jumpers. I mean, that's a great book too. I mean, you've had lots of, you know, books come out and be sold in shops and stuff like that. So,
well, so Steve Bryan is Athena Voltaire, and I love Steve. He's a great dude. He is like straight up comic book. He is comic books to me. You know, like he is a self-starter that has had, you know, success. Athena was at Dark Horse. It's at Action Lab now. He's been one of the most, how do I describe, just resilient and driven and passionate dudes that you'll ever talk to. Right.
Yeah.
But what, you know, every time people ask me about that, they're like, you know, and you know, you kind of just alluded to it, but there are really only five levels of success in comic books. And the first one is literally doing it. It's and so, yes, I've had that success where I've put out a lot of books and I've had some critical acclaim and I've had some fandom that's into my stuff. So it really boils down to, let me see if I can figure this one out. I literally, I wrote it out yesterday. Let me see if I can't figure out where I put that, but it was literally, it's making it. It's writing it, first of all. Then it's collaborating with someone if you're not drawing it yourself. So that's like step two, is now you're a team of people, right?
Yeah.
The third is it gets published or picked up. The fourth, and this is the most important one. And by the way, none of this involves any monetary value at all, right?
Sure.
These are just steps of success that you can have. Sure. The fourth is putting it out and having some form of fandom reflected back at you. Someone read it and was driven to say, I love that, or I fucking hated it. And I actually like the latter more. I like when I've written something that has driven someone to just be like, man, I hate this. Because like,
really?
I've warranted some kind of reaction that you were passionate enough to either love it or hate it.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that hate is just as important as love, because you realize at that moment that not everything you write is going to be for everybody.
Yeah.
And you may actually get some criticism that drives you to be better, or drives you to realize what your mistake was in the first place.
Sure.
Right. Super important. And then the fifth is Fortune and Glory, right? Which like is the problem with that is
Brian Michael Bendis, Alan Moore, Grant Morrison. Is that what we're talking about?
Mark Millar.
Mark Millar. Yeah.
But it's like, you know, like that is, if you got into the business for that, you're screwed. There's no way. Like that's the whole reason that comics is beating your head up against a wall, just to see how tough that wall is or how tough your head is. And you know, again, you can't see it, but the first check I ever got in comics, which isn't to say that I haven't gotten paid for comics before, but I've never been sent a check. Yeah. But like I have like my Dark Horse check on my wall. And you know, obviously that was like last year, right? It wasn't even like, and it's not a huge amount of money. It's just like, hey, I've never been sent a check before. I've always had people like direct deposit money into my account or, you know, PayPal me or whatever it is. And like, this came and I was like, I'm going to put this on my wall to remind me that anything is possible.
Yeah.
And if I need to, you know, headbutt a wall harder, I just look up and go, it's there. It's right there on the wall. And I may be hitting my head up against that wall, but I know that it's there, you know?
Yeah. So. No, it's interesting. The sort of getting paid aspect. It's funny because I've done conventions with my own like little dinky self-published comic and, just getting that $3 sometimes, you know, I mean, it's just really, you know, from a complete stranger and they look at it and they're like, oh, this looks cool. Like that for me has been like an experience where I'm just like, oh, okay. And you're at a convention. So you're so busy and you're looking around and you're like a carnival barker, like, hey, you want to come and look at my book? But thinking about it and then coming home and looking how much you made and versus like how much the table costs and like all that stuff, you forget about that sort of precious moment where somebody handed you money or like a kid or something looked at it and, you know, and you don't relish in the importance of that. But it's funny because it brings me to sort of like another thing. I mean, you've been with Action Lab, you're making your own stuff. And a lot of times I have a lot of people come on to my podcast and talk about, you know, that their comic was originally a movie script or they want it to be a TV show or their success is balanced on whether it becomes a TV show or a movie or it gets optioned and stuff like that, which leads me to my own internal question. Like what are comics for at this point? You know what I'm saying? Like, what are comics? Like, are they legitimately like the thing that so many fans have been fighting for years and years and years is like, this is like a legit art form, right? Like this is a thing. And obviously there's monetary, you know, considerations that need to be put into that. You know, people need to make money, but it seems to me like just even ever more so than before, unless you're talking about like Marvel, DC, like at the highest level, you know, making movies, it seems like the actual art form of comics is not something that people necessarily have. And I think respect is the wrong term that I'm looking for, but it's the first one that pops in my head. Have a respect for it. Like comics are a thing, right? Like it's a thing that we all love, but at the same time, I just hear it talked about like it's like a little bit of like an afterthought, like it's only used to get to something else. Do you understand what I'm saying? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you know, I can only speak for myself and like,
sure.
I remember like my dad and I, he's a muggle. He's like normal as hell, right? Like he's into sports and stuff like that.
Sure.
Coors Light and whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember he worked for Pac Bell back in the day and we were in California and he got shipped out to New York. They were just building infrastructure out there and he was gone for like 2 years.
Okay.
And he would come back like once a month and he would come back with a stack of comic books because, you know, like back in the day, there weren't very many comic book shops. And in New York, there were like, you know, three really good ones.
Yeah.
So like he'd come home with, you know, not to date myself, but he'd come home with stuff like first prints of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number one and and Wolverine, you know, the Frank Miller miniseries and stuff like that. He would go in there and he knew that that was my thing. And he would go in there not knowing that much, but he would ask the comic slinger behind the counter, like, what's cool this week? And he would just collect comics for me and then bring them home. And then we'd read them together.
Yeah.
And that was the way I connected to my dad. So like when I realized that I had stories to tell and I had, and comics were my like literal first love and the only connection I really have with my dad, I've been in it since then. I mean, I've been drawing since I was 12. Right.
Yeah.
So realizing that I was only drawing to tell stories meant that I was going to pivot into writing comic books. And so to me, I don't necessarily write comic books to make movies out of them. I love that comics are like movies in that they are an unlimited budget movie, right? You can do every comic book is Ready Player One. You know what I mean? It's like, and every comic book is a love letter to something that we either loved growing up or something that we love genre wise or whatever it is, right? Yeah. So is the end game movies and film? I think it unfortunately is a necessity at this point that everyone has that dream and hope, because to keep pounding your head up against that wall for top ramen and Oreo thins, not even real Oreos, is a tough pill to swallow for a lot of people. So, and I think that depending on who you are as an artist, like comics can mean a paycheck, you know, like for writers, I feel like potentially, you've got to lean in a little bit more because on the heart aspect of it, because your talent isn't so outwardly seen. Like I can work with an artist that like can just hold something up and be like, check this out. And you're like, wow, that's a super awesome drawing of Wolverine. Whereas if I'm like, man, I'm writing, you know, a story about a Canadian hero, that's got claws coming out of his hands. Wow, that doesn't sound very interesting coming from me. But if that artist shows you that drawing, you're like, wow, that's so badass.
Yeah.
So I feel like artists get a little bit more instant gratification. Writers have it a little tougher. And then, I you would say that arguably writers get paid less, but at the end of the day, they get more creative credit, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
It is definitely a writer's industry. And the artists are there to facilitate that. And
do you think so? That's a really interesting way of looking at it.
But I think that it's probably easier to become famous as an artist. See what I'm saying?
Really? Like, I mean, I don't. Well, obviously, you can't create something without a writer. But I've seen so many writers that are, I mean, artists that are bad writers, like succeed because of the visuals of their story.
Yeah.
It seems to me, and I know that for me, when I was collecting comics, it was the art that drew me in. So I would miss out on a lot of like considered classic stuff. You know what I mean? Because there were artists that I just was like, or I would pick up a book and just be like, no, just not going to read that because of the visuals. So it's interesting to me how, but I mean, to your point, I mean, you can't have anything without somebody writing it, right? I mean coming up with the idea.
Like Jonathan Hickman is one of my favorite writers. He's frigging amazing. And everything he writes blows my mind. And and I always pray that he's got a really competent artist on his stuff, because without that artist, his ideas are so out there half the time that and with the X-Men stuff, especially these days, he's getting a lot more praise than any of the artists, in my opinion. But in the grand scheme of things, the artist is the thing that you see up front. Right.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm, you know, what you were saying is, you missed out on so many classics because you were like into the art of it. Right.
Yeah.
I feel like most people do gravitate towards the art, but then when a writer gets famous, they get like stupid famous, you know? But climbing the ladder is probably easier for a very good artist than a very good writer, in my opinion. Like we pitched that Jenny Zero book to Dark Horse, and I'm the worst at pitching things, and I should be better because I've seen so many pitches as, you know, the actual creative director.
Yeah.
But like my version of pitching Jenny Zero was walking around showing editors pages on my phone. And literally just being like, here, take my phone and take a look at this. And then like they'll scroll the PDF of it. And then they're like, whoa, it looks so awesome because of Magenta King is a fantastic artist.
Yeah.
But they're then like, well, what's the story? And I had my editor at Dark Horse be like, I really like this story, but this artist is really elevating everything that you guys are doing. And
oh, wow.
I didn't take offense to that at all because I was like, of course, that's why I'm showing it to you on my phone, because I know that you're going to look at this and be like, what am I looking at? You know? And so art does sell the story first in comics. You know, it's an interesting dichotomy. And then, you know, at the end of the day, Brockton and I are going to get credit for creating it because we brought it to Magenta, but without Magenta doing all of that artwork,
sure,
we'd be out of luck. We'd be way out of luck.
Yeah.
So,
Oh, no, it's a really interesting way of, I mean, pretty good way of like looking at, you know, how the whole writer artist thing kind of breaks down. It's yeah. I mean, it's funny because one can't function without the other, but for me, it was always, you know, and I don't want to bring any particular like image artist to the forefront, but I just remember picking up, like, there were certain artists in the 90s who I was just like, this is all just visual for me. Like, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, if I sit down and actually try and read this and make sense of what I'm reading right now, there's nothing there. But visually at the time, I thought, oh, wow, like, this is great. And this is why this is selling. So it's just an interesting balance. But, you know, we went through that period in the 90s and the aughts where the writer definitely came to the forefront. But I feel like art, like comics, is like the ultimate sort of balance, right? Where you need them both to like work really well together.
I mean, that's why John Byrne is a legend, right? Because he does both pretty damn well, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
But you know, and that's why there's a difference between like, this is not begrudging to Dale Keown, but that's why there's a huge difference for me for The Incredible Hulk, written by Peter David, drawn by Dale Keown, and Pitt.
Sure.
Written and drawn by Dale Keown. They're both still beautiful, but one has just so many layers to it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, like, and again, Peter David was a writer that I would follow anywhere he went. I was right behind him, just eating that up, you know?
Sure.
And he got really blessed by working with a ton of great artists.
Yeah.
So, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely is a balance. I think that, there are probably going to be people that disagree with me about, you know, whether or not it's an artist world or a writer's world. But I think comics, like to your point, are both. And as a fan, depending on how you gravitate, it could be either or.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the best way to look at it for me.
But granted, I've seen a lot of stuff lately published, like through companies and stuff, where I have picked up the art, and maybe it's just because things have developed towards digital, and I don't want to sound like an old guy or anything like that. I mean, I am old, but there's a lot of stuff that I see published where when I was a kid and I was gravitating towards just art, like the art would not have done it for me. Like I would have just been, and I've definitely, even my own book, like I look at my own work, and I've said this before on the podcast, where it's like, I hate my own stuff. Like I look at it and it takes such an effort to be like, okay, this is fine. It's done. And then, you know, you mentioned John Byrne and maybe some of those older guys compared to the image thing. There's a lot of times where I look at stuff and I was like, well, this got published like visually. And I'm like, well, maybe people should half-ass it a bit. Like I don't know. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Like you've seen those books where stuff gets picked up and the art maybe doesn't do it for you, or you're just like, oh no, this is just like definitely not great art. You know what I mean? But it's good enough. Like, and so what is, you know, I don't even know what I'm trying to say at this point.
Well, you know, it's crazy. I mean, like to your point though, there's a ton of books out there, and this is crazy though about the 90s. It's really indicative of like the weird vibe that we were getting. I think Image threw everything off.
Yeah.
Like, and like, then you got like Marvel trying to get people like Danny Bolandi and Dan Panosian to ape some of the other things that were going around at Image at the time.
Yeah.
And like those Marvel books suffered because it's like, you don't get it. You just don't get the point of it, right? Like,
yeah.
The thing about the Image guys were they had what they did really, really well boiled down to their, like, I don't want to say basic, but purest elements.
Yeah.
And that isn't always good storytelling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a lot of flash and a lot of like bang, a lot of pockets. And
yeah.
Big guns and shit. But it's like, it's like, you know, like if you look at that from the outside and don't understand how they're doing or what they're doing, you're going to get a watered down version of it. So like, to me, it's a lot like the kids that just draw anime. And again, I don't want to disparage. I want everyone to draw. I want everyone to create.
Yeah,
but you cannot just draw like your version of an anime character in a pinup. And it, that's not manga.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
just, you're distilling it down to what you perceive as its basest elements.
For sure.
And you're missing a lot of the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like when I see a lot of anime kids that come up to my table and want me to look at their portfolio, the first thing I say is, look, draw backgrounds, get used to hyper detail. If you're going to do a close up of a hand with a sword, that sword has to be articulate and ornate.
Yeah.
And the further you get away from that in manga, the simpler the drawing becomes.
Yeah.
But you can't just, it's like everything now has speed lines. It's like, you missed the point, guys. Like, yes, that's in there, but that's not every scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Plus they also have assistants drawing their background.
Right? Oh man. Yeah. Well, you know, now we all sort of do, like, you could do, you know, when Google SketchUp came out, I was like, I'm doing that.
What is Google
sure.
SketchUp? I don't even know what that is.
It's a free thing. I don't know if it still exists, but I remember hearing Mike Norton talk about it. And Google SketchUp, you could download 3D models that you can export into JPEGs. And then you take that and you can throw it behind your characters and drawings and then sketch over it so that you don't have to do any of the perspective work or any of the detail.
Wow.
It's all there. And you can like download a big rig truck and then like turn it any direction, go anywhere you want on it, and then export it as a JPEG and then throw it into Photoshop. So
that is so... like, that is sacrilege to me hearing that. But you know what? It's so funny, though, because it's a discovery that I mean, it's something that I recently, maybe not recently, but in the past couple of years, where I was watching a documentary on YouTube about anime artists, and the dude took a picture and like put it, and I was like, wait, he's tracing that. Like, what is he doing? Like, you're not allowed to do that. And then going deeper down into it and discovering that a lot of manga artists, heck, you know, US artists do the same thing. I mean, it's beyond even using sort of like reference. It's like they're just, you know, putting it on a light table and stuff like that. And I was just blown away by that, because for years and years and years, you know, I was just like, no, you just have to know how to draw a building. Like, you just have to know, like, you just, it just pops out of your head, you know, like you draw so much, like, look at George Perez, like, you should be like him. You know what I mean? And, you know, that's not, I'm not saying that George Perez traces buildings. I'm sure he doesn't. He's probably drawn so many buildings, but at the same time, there's definitely stuff that I've seen now that I'm becoming aware of it where I'm like, is that traced or is that like, what did they do? Like, and it's fascinating.
I think the best way to not have your brain explode over that is to say, okay, all of these people have a story to tell, or they're getting paid to tell a story, and they're trying to facilitate that story in the best way they can.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like hiring other people to draw it for me, even though I can draw.
Yeah.
For some people, it's getting a Google SketchUp. I think that there's another... program, what's it called?
I'm sure there's a lot of them by now.
Yeah, I have, you know, I it's so funny, I bought this and I can't remember the name of the program because that's how little I draw, but it's not SketchUp, but it's Clip Studio.
I was just gonna say, I think that they offer the same thing, like
the
3D
same
models
sort of
now.
Thing and speed lines that you just throw behind and, you know, textures and all that stuff. So it's like, it, you know, for comic books, sometimes it's how fast can I get it done? Sometimes it's how easy can I get it done?
Yeah.
You know, but like, I think that the problem is that people still consider comics a bastard art form. And we brought, you know, you said that earlier. It's just like, you know, it doesn't get that kind of respect. But I like that it's a bastard art form. I like that anything is possible. And I like that you can sometimes, like, I have stories that I'm like, no one's ever going to want to read this. No one's ever going to want to like support this, or it's never going to be a movie, right?
Yeah,
this is for me.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And there's plenty of ideas that I have that I'm like, nah, that's just for me. It's never going to get made into anything ever.
Yeah.
And then I have other ideas where I'm like, that would make a really, you know, a really great movie or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah. No, that's
but great. I never start with let's make a movie. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
sure. Well, speaking of ideas, let's go back to Spores, The Broken Circle, because. You know, that's kind of what we're here to talk about. But, you know, I love talking about all kinds of different things on this podcast. But I mean, again, Spores, The Broken Circle is on Kickstarter. We mentioned that in the beginning. I mean, you mentioned that it is a zombie thing, although it sounds like it's going to maybe morph into something else with this new chapter. So, I mean, I'm assuming that you're like a horror zombie guy, right? Like you like zombies, like you love.
You know, I do love horror. I would say that like there, but. Like comedy, It's really hard for me to be like, that's an A plus movie. You know what I mean? Like, there's like every horror movie is a roller coaster. Every comedy is a roller coaster. It's so subjective, right?
Yeah.
And so with most of my stuff, like I'm writing a book with Jess Balboni called Banshees. I did Cyrus Perkins, The Haunted Taxicab. I think I gravitate towards the darkness a bit.
Sure.
And I gravitate towards the comedy. So if I can somehow get both of those things rolling in the right direction, that's how I go. You know, with Banshees though, with Jessica, I wrote it, but we came up with the story together and she worked very hard editing me, which, you know, was a new experience and it was a good experience. But a lot of what I would imbue humor into, she was like, don't do it, you know? And, and so that book is straight horror, you know, okay. And it's horror mystery. Whereas like a lot of my stuff is kind of like fun loving, you know, with Spores, The Broken Circle, we're definitely like with Prom of the Dead, there's some fun, like on the nose references and on the nose humor. And a lot of that is not in The Broken Circle. Like it's getting progressively darker and becoming more of what the story is. But I definitely, you know, the body count in Prom of the Dead was so high that I was like, I need to make everyone care about these characters. Like,
okay.
I can't, you know, like the thing that I hate about horror movies is, you know, random deaths that, yeah, maybe it's cool and gory or whatever it is. But like, if I don't care about the characters, I don't care that they died, you know?
Yeah.
You're just throwing another Jawa on a burning pile of Jawas to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I think that a lot of particularly old horror movies kind of like leaned on the thing that all humans were empathetic and cared about somebody getting killed in a horrible way. And that is obviously not necessarily the case. You know what I mean? Where it's like you go into a horror movie and it's like, yeah, that dude just got the top of his head cut off. That was awesome. You know what I mean? So, you know, there just ended up being sort of like more of that where people just gravitated towards, you know, cool deaths or the gore of it all. And but it's interesting, but
that's like the Image Comics effect of horror movies. Like cause Halloween, OG Halloween to me is the purest form of the slasher genre. And I think only three people died in that movie, maybe five, but like by the time you get to Halloween 2, it's like just bodies and bodies and bodies. And you're like, no one cares. You only cared because it was Laurie Strode.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, and then, you know, that torch was picked up by people that were like, let's do what they did in Halloween, but let's just take what we think people liked about it, which is the body count and the gore and make all these other movies. And I think that's why I like, Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one so much, because it's like, you really do care. And you did bring back the kind of like, strong feminine hero, and you got a really good concept and story and a decent execution on it and the gore. Right.
Yeah.
And then that became a cartoon of itself. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, even the people that created the things that were awesome, tend to fall off a cliff, like Halloween 2 and, you know, let's go Nightmare, New Nightmare. I think that there are elements of the Nightmare, movies that I like about all of the movies, but they just get like progressively cheesier and jokey. You know?
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, for me, at least with horror, it's like a balance. Like I love stuff like Ash versus the Evil Dead or like Evil Dead 2 and stuff like that. But I tend to really gravitate towards like really dark, disturbing stuff because I'm sort of looking for, I mean, the reason to go to the movies or the reason to sort of experience anything is to sort of experience emotions in my life that you're not going to experience like every day. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I don't necessarily want like the darkness to necessarily happen to me or anyone, but seeing it projected on the screen and going through those like intense emotions is for me the reason why I like movies. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I'm a softie. I like crying during movies. I like, you know, I like getting wrapped up and stuff. So there tends to be, you know, if it's just like a hack and slash sort of thing, or if something gets dragged on for too long and you become sort of like desensitized to it, like something like the Walking Dead TV show, where after a while I was just like, okay, like, what are we doing here? Like, you know, then, yeah, I just sort of check out. But to
you
your
phase
point,
out, yeah.
Yeah. But these days, because I've seen so many movies and been exposed to so many things, because again, I'm old. It's definitely takes like a special thing to make me to go like, holy cow, what the F was that? You know what I mean? Like just go like, oh my God, and just be freaked out by something, you know? Maybe I've been desensitized.
I think that's what's probably the best thing about comics is it's probably the purest form of escapism that you can have, right?
Sure.
I mean, the minute that you throw a cape on someone, that's something, and that person flies, it's like, we've never seen that before. And now, I mean, obviously we have, and they've gotten better and better at doing it. But, you know, like when Christopher Reeves put on that cape and flew it through the air, you were like, wow, it is magic. Right?
Yeah.
And that's pure escapism. And I think that horror is the same. And I think you're right. You can experience a range of emotion if done right.
Yeah.
If the movie is done right. Right.
Yeah.
Or if the comic is done right. Now, horror and comics, that's another thing that's really
hard
to do.
I was going to ask you, that was my next thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, like, honestly, I feel like I write good characters. I feel like if you can write a good character, the situation that you put them in, and as dire or as fun or as emotionally satisfying as it can be, it starts with the characters, right?
Yeah.
So like if I want to write a teen dramedy about a zombie invasion, I have to make those characters great.
Sure.
Right? And I think that's what, you know, kind of Kirkman did in The Walking Dead, the comic.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if they were necessarily as successful with the TV show.
Yeah. I mean, I stuck in with the show for a long time, but the comic book to me is gold, and I still have to catch up to the last several chapters. Cause I've got a lot, but I remember when I was still going week to week to a comic book shop, like The Walking Dead was the thing, you know, that I really looked forward to. The TV show, I stuck in for like 3 or 4. I think once Negan showed up, it just got a little bit like, this guy, like he wasn't as intense as the comic. And I just felt like they didn't, you know, stick the landing with that. And
I think that's what the comic did really, really well.
Yeah.
And kind of what I was trying to do with The Broken Circle is like, there's a huge gray area when you're dealing with like apocalyptic stories like this, like who really is the villain? Like why would a survivor be considered a villain, and how far do they go to ensure their own survival? And then does that make them the villain? Right.
Yeah.
So like Kirkman was really good about making a villain a villain. Like Negan early on didn't have any redeeming qualities, and neither did the governor. Right.
Yeah.
Whereas like the TV show felt like, because it was for a different consumer, they had to like
soften it
and give them a backstory where I'm like, nah, man, just let Hitler be Hitler. Like, I don't need to know about Hitler's lack of ball.
I don't care. Are on the same page. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's so interesting, because one of the things that I love to point out about, like one of the things I always point out to people is like the Punisher movies, right? The Punisher is basically like Dirty Harry, right? Or like Death Wish, right? And whenever you had like a Dirty Harry or a Death Wish in the 70s, even though it's like 80s, like projecting gun, you know, fascist, whatever, you know, I'm not even going to get into that. But the thing that they always had, like in Death Wish or whatever, was criminals who, you know, obviously there's racial profiling and whatever. I don't even want to get into that. But you had the bad guys be awful. Like, you know what I mean? They were awful. Like, and in the comics in the beginning, once they sort of like made him a hero, they had the bad guys be like these awful drug dealer, king lord, drug lord things. And the thing that I've always said that you need in a villain, for particularly that type of person, like the Punisher, who's going to do awful things that you can't always be on board with, is a villain who is just reprehensible. Like you can't, like, I don't need to know that his father abused him when he was little, or, you know, that he didn't get enough candy at the candy. I don't need to know any of that stuff. What you need is a villain that everyone can just go, I want that guy dead. Yeah. Kill that guy. Like, that's the guy. And for a character, for something. So whenever they made like the Punisher, the movie, they made John Travolta this like weird, wacky, like dopey, like sort of villain. I was just like, this doesn't work, because I don't care about that villain enough to want to kill him, or, you know. So I mean, once they sort of maybe got to the Punisher TV show, they got to that level more. But that's the sort of thing that I'm always like, if you're going to have a hero that needs to cross the line, you need to show the audience this is why he has to cross the line. You know what I mean? Right?
Right. And that's, it's totally true. And that's the hardest thing about writing the second volume is there are going to be clear lines drawn.
Yeah.
And I have to tell that story in 4 issues worth of time. And by the time I'm done with it, I need everyone to be satisfied with repercussions.
Sure.
The repercussions that are coming. Right.
Sure.
And I like the idea that I'm not too worried about it, but at the same time, like I feel like COVID has taught us that children are adaptable. Uh-huh. But if children are left on their own accord and it's a Lord of the Flies situation,
yeah,
how bad does it get? If I started with this group of solid characters that all existed in a world with a hierarchy, what happens? And it's a high school hierarchy, but how does that shift when the world is ending and you're left to your own devices? And so that's kind of where we're at with the Broken Circle. And obviously just by the title, you know, the circle's broken. And, you know, we'll see if people are satisfied. I think that people really, really like Prom the Dead because it was in on its own joke. Like it was a world where Robert Kirkman's The Walking Dead exists as a TV show where Night of the Living Dead and everything is pop culture. So that in itself separates itself from most of the zombie things. Like what I don't like about zombie stuff is they never explain what the virus is.
Yeah.
Everyone's completely confused by, you know, people walking around that are dead. I mean, you know, if it was a shuffling zombie outside, you would know to cross the street right away. And you would know to lock your door, right?
Yeah. So like, there's people that I cross the street, like regular living people that,
Right, yeah. Right. So like to me, a lot of like that stuff feels like you're already taking me out of reality. You know what I mean? Like that's why Rick wakes up from a coma.
Yeah.
And the world has gone to hell because there's no way he wanted to explain what was going on in there. And like, I think that Prom of the Dead and the Broken Circle and the Spores trilogy are going to peel the onion a bit more.
Yeah.
And it really is about what is happening to these kids as they're trying to become adults. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, in the first volume, you show what starts it, right? I mean, so there's no real mystery to that. But I mean, as it, you know, develops and stuff, have you ever seen or read Day of the Triffids? Like, have you, so there is a BBC, it's a 70s one. I think it's available on DVD. They did it was originally a novel. There's like an old 50s or 60s adaptation, which I don't think for me is not necessarily great, but it's kind of considered one of those like B movie, like classics, but they did a BBC adaptation in like the 80s or late 70s. And I think you might be able to find it on Amazon. I think they released it in the US, but it's called Day of the Triffids and it's a really good miniseries, but it's different than what you're doing. Basically the plants like make people blind and all of society like disappears like in a night or something. It's really, really, I remember being creeped out by it and buying it on DVD and being like, oh, this kind of held up. So, but this sort of thing, like I said earlier, is a Day of the Triffids, like Dawn of the Dead. I don't think you explain like necessarily where they come from, but you do explain like what is happening, what is causing it. So
yeah, the most recent thing that I saw that was fantastic, by the way, but it was a movie called The Girl with All the Gifts.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, yeah.
That's a great one. Yeah. By the way, there's nothing worse than writing something and then like seeing something like that and being like, well, you know, now I got to watch it to make sure that I don't do what they
yeah,
do.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
But like, yeah, I mean, you mentioned Double Jumpers earlier, but like, I'm very proud to say that that came out years before they redid Jumanji and basically did what I did in Double Jumpers, which I'm like, whoa, they literally almost beat for beat took elements of Double Jumpers. I'm not saying that they read it and said, yeah, let's do this, but like, you know, there's a ton of stuff. And then like I did Double Jumpers 2 and I was like, well, Double Jumpers 2 is different because of this. And then they did Jumanji 2 and it was the same premise. And I was sons of bitches. Like they switched bodies and went into the video game and shit. And I was like, oh my God. I mean, feels good to be on the pulse of something, but I wish it wasn't so on the nose.
Yeah. Well, let me sort of just wrap this up with one question about comics and horror, and it may, you know, do you think it's possible? Because I mean, I've read a lot of comics, and honestly, like yours is one of the better ones that I've read. I mean, I really enjoyed it and liked it, which is why you have my quote on the first volume. I don't really, if I don't like something, I don't embrace it, or I try to be nice, but
if you had said something scathing, I still would have put it on the back of the cover.
But I didn't, because I really liked it. But the thing that I find in a lot of like horror books, and maybe it's gotten better over the years, there's a couple of like Junji Ito who is just like a master as far as like just the freaking you out factor. Do you think comics can be, because I mean, I know that there's an argument, there's a debate, like, can they be scary? Do you think they can be like really, really scary? Because I know sometimes, a lot of times I pick up horror books and it was like sort of like what we were saying about comics, which is just like, it's just gore. It's just TNA. It's just, it's not scary. It's not freaking me out. So what are your opinions on that?
That's a tough one. That is a really tough. So I think you can get really creeped out. I think getting creeped out is a thing. I think that there can be a level of dread in comics that could rival movies or TV, in that you've got gutters and page turns, right? Yeah. So like, if you time it right, you can shock the hell out of someone on a page turn, right?
Yeah.
And that might even be more effective than some movies.
Yeah.
Right. Whether or not something can be scary, I think that's all subjective too. What scares you, right? Like, if something is, if you don't like demon possession, as an example, like exorcism type stuff, right?
Yeah.
You could probably creep someone out really, really bad with a comic book, because you can, depending on who's drawing that thing, they could go for it.
Yeah.
Will that be as, I mean, it's probably going to be scarier than Emily Rose, which wasn't scary at all. You know, that was like a weird procedural exorcist movie.
Yeah.
So I think that, it can be done. I think that it's harder to do, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would agree with you. I mean, I've read a lot of stuff. I mean, I mentioned Junji Ito. I like read his stuff and I'm like, this is disturbing. And then there was a manga, I cannot remember the name of it, but I'll never forget like reading it. And there was like a transformation that occurred to like a monster, and I was like, wow, they did a really good job. And then again, another manga, Dragonhead. Have you ever heard of Dragonhead? Oh, it's about like a volcano explodes in Japan, and these kids are on a train trip, like to go on a train, and the train gets caught in this tunnel, and they're like stuck in this tunnel trying to get out. And then eventually do get out, but the world is like destroyed. Like, and that is one of the scariest things I've read. And I just love apocalypse fiction and end of the world stuff. So it may just be me, but I was like, wow, you guys did an excellent job. But I agree with you. I think that it is hard in comics. Like I do pick up a lot of, I actually started avoiding them for a while. I mean, the EC stuff is good, you know, EC comics like Tales from the Crypt, but I don't know that it's necessarily scary. It's more sort of like, oh, this is a disturbing idea, or maybe even fun, depending on how demented you are. I don't know, but I mean, either way, your book is great. I mean, I enjoyed Prom of the Dead a lot, and I have thrown some money to Spores, The Broken Circle, which is what you should be looking for on Kickstarter right now. You know, go and support it. But Spores, The Broken Circle is in black and white, right? Not color.
No, it will be colored.
Oh, it will. So, oh, okay.
Yeah. So what's happening there? Like most of us in comics, I'm pretty much a jack of all trades, and I'm a really good colorist, but I was holding out on incorporating that into the budget until after the Kickstarter to see if I was going to color it for free or if I was going to be able to hire in someone. So right now it's just got preview art that's black and white. And the first issues that people, you know, that are available there, those are like basically preview issues. It'll be a whole first issue.
Sure.
But it'll be in black and white. And then the trade paperback will be in full color.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, this is awesome. Like, this is great. Again, the project is called Spores, The Broken Circle. It is on Kickstarter right now. Go and throw your money at it. I have been speaking with Dave Dwanch, who is a jack of all trades in the comics biz. I mean, I'm just happy to have you on, man. Thank you for coming on. It's been great chatting with you.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been too long since we've been able to share space together. So it's really good to see you and really good to talk to you, brother.
Yeah, yeah. No. Great chatting with you. And I can't wait to see you at hopefully at a convention or something in the next year or so. Who knows when they're coming back. But luckily, I think we've avoided the worst of our own apocalypse. But you can always check out Dave Dwanch's apocalypse in Spores, The Broken Circle. Now on Kickstarter. You like how I did that?
Oh man, that was so good. That was, like...
it was smooth. Smooth. In the meantime, my name is Christian Horn, and this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Although I haven't been great about social media stuff lately, I apologize. I should be better. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. And thank you for listening. Go support Spores, The Broken Circle on Kickstarter, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
Part-time fanboy.